Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, and then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
The music world moves fast. Want to stay up to date on the latest albums and get in-depth examinations with the artists? Check out Consequence of Sound, the podcast. Bite-sized album reviews for the music fan on the go who wants to stay in the know, and much more. Subscribe to the series on iTunes or your favorite podcast provider, and let the writers of Consequence of Sound steer you right. Check it out at consequenceofsound.net/COS podcast. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound and the Consequence Podcast Network. Hey, do me a favor. Hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now, whether that's Apple Podcasts, at iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere you're listening from right now, please do hit that subscribe button. We release interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and would love to keep you up to date on all those. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest is Mark Eitzel, lead singer of American Music Club, and of course, a long, storied, historied solo career that I am a huge fan of. We're going to be doing some time traveling with Mark Eitzel today. We're going to start in 1989 for American Music Club's United Kingdom record. Then we'll hit to the 25th anniversary of the San Francisco record. That was the record that more or less broke up the band. And we'll talk about those final days of American Music Club. And then we'll jump to 2009 for a 10th anniversary of one of his solo records called Klamath. And after that, he gives us the scoop on what to expect next. Not just from his next solo record, but from the American Music Club camp. It's Kyle Meredith with Mark Eitzel.
Hey, this is Mark Eitzel.
Hey, first off, did I read right? You got a birthday, a big birthday coming up, right?
Oh, let's not. Can we not? I mean, I got a gun loaded to my head. Can we not?
Hey, happy birthday. I'm glad you're still here.
Yeah, thanks.
I just noticed that we'll just keep it at the dates. How about that? We'll just keep it at the date that there is a birthday on the way.
Yeah.
Well, with that present in mind, this whole thing, I was hoping to jump way back in time with you. In fact, there's three, I call them the big round number anniversaries, which I like to talk about. And you've got three albums that are sort of celebrating that. Talking about United Kingdom, 30th anniversary, San Francisco's 25th anniversary, and Klamath. Am I saying that right? Klamath?
Yeah.
Yeah. 10th anniversary on that one, too. So lots going on with the big stuff. So as long as you're all right with hopping in the time machine, I feel like I figured we'd start back at the old 1989.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah. So 30th anniversary of the United Kingdom. Now this is an interesting record, and I think some fans have always debated where this falls in the American Music Club catalog, because it's I don't know, how do you look at this record? It's sort of a hodgepodge, and it was only released in the UK, right?
Well, after we did California, Demon Records wanted us to make another one right away, and the guy who ran the record label thought, let's not, he didn't want to lose us in the contract, you know, like, so he said, let's make a covers record. So, well, a record of older songs done live. Let's do a live record. And I was like, well, I got all these songs written. And he said, I don't care, you know, let's just do a live record. So we spent about a month recording a live record, working up to it. And then we did the live record, and it wasn't that great. And again, I said, look, I got all these songs. He said, I don't care. So it went back and forth. The record company said, okay, well, we don't really want this live record, and you know it's not very good, so what do we do? And I think the owner of the record company had already taken the money, so he's like, fuck it. Fuck it. Because that was his favorite expression. Fuck it. So fuck it. Let's record a record. Fuck it. Fuck you. Fuck your songs. Fucking record it. So we did, you know, and I think it's pretty good. I like a lot of it. I the songwriting could use a little work, but I think it's good.
Well, I mean, I think every songwriter thinks that, especially when they look back to, you know, their younger selves. But there are beautiful songs all over this. You know, I was going to ask about a couple of them, too. And let's start out with Heaven in Your Hands.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I have no context of what any of these songs are about, you know, and this was a record that I didn't really even familiarize myself with until a few years ago, just because these days it's sort of hard to find on top of that. I mean, it's not like it's on the streaming services or anything like that. But so, let's start with that one. What do you remember about that song? Because it's such a beautiful song.
It's just sort of an attempt. I mean, I don't know. I get accused a lot of being like Billy Joel.
Really?
God, it's awful. Who is not, you know, Billy Joel, who is not the enemy necessarily, you know, toxic masculinity aside. So I don't know. I think I was just trying to write a classic kind of love song.
Well, no, it comes off as a classic love song. At least you've succeeded in that part. I never would have crossed my mind to compare it to Billy Joel, though. So it's...
No, you don't live my life. I mean, it's like everyone is like, you know, for years, that's always been the thing. So when I look back at a song like that, I'm like, ugh, the mushy sentimentality, the nostalgia for joy, the, you know, the all this shit. I don't know. Look, you're asking the wrong person. I look back and I think, rewrite the motherfucker, but, you know, you know, I don't really have a lot of, you know, like, I look back on these songs, it's like, oh, well, I for juvenilia, I guess they're okay, but, yeah. You know, I don't know.
Well, it's when we were also introduced to Kathleen by name in a song, which, of course, became a big fan favorite. I was reading an interview around the time where you said Kathleen wasn't very happy that her name was in the song, though.
Oh, fuck no. And I look back and I feel regret that she was. I mean, this poor girl, it's like, you know, I'm a gay man, but I was really in love with her, and you know, I was 19 when I met her. You know, like, if I had any kind of balls, I would have not been with her for so long. But she moved to San Francisco with me, and we lived together for all the time she was here. And then, I don't think it helped that these songs were. I wrote them as a tribute to her, but also I wrote them because it was the only emotional experience that I was having.
Right.
You know, so yeah, she really fucking hated it.
On the other side, you know, so you'd mentioned California, and there's, you know, for whatever level, I mean, that's AMC's breakthrough at the moment. You know, that's where the critical acclaim really starts rolling in. And you were tagged with a scene, and you're, you know, so that's where we learn the words, you know, slowcore and stuff like that. Although I don't know if it was completely, you know, that word was around at that point, but definitely in the college music scene, this was a big thing at the same time. And I, that's what I was sort of wondering, like at that time, you know, we can always look back in history and paint things in a certain way. Did you feel like you were a part of a scene at that time?
Well, you know, when you're young, when you're in your early 20s in a city, and everyone is doing similar things, you know, it wasn't called slowcore. It was sort of like a new acoustic sort of thing. Because, you know, I was, you know, at the time I was, you know, like old. I think I was 26, 27. And we were starting to embrace. I mean, the thing is about music then, you know, lots of bands sang with English accents, you know.
Right.
It was, and I had friends, they all sang with English accents. It was really exciting, you know, and it was awful, you know. And I think because really, basically, we were huge fans of English music, everything from Joy Division to, oh, everybody. I mean, you know, Ian McCullough. I mean, we just made and although we had other elements, I mean, Voodoo played in a country western band for a while. And Danny was definitely more in the Carter family than he was in the Joy Division. So we kind of brought all those roots into sort of an anti-punk thing because we were all sort of invested with punk. So we thought, fuck it. Mm-hmm. Punk is just a stupid idea. So let's do something else. And I guess in San Francisco at the time, there was sort of a scene like that. You know, definitely we had friends.
Yeah.
So I don't know. If you know, so we had friends who were in bands, you know. So we would always go to their shows. They would always come to our shows kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So, yeah. So I guess we were part of the scene. But
And then getting, I mean, at that point, you were on a major label at this point, yeah? In the U.S. or no? That came later. That came afterwards.
No. We were on Frontier Records.
Some of that came afterwards, which sort of leads, you know, into that 25th anniversary of San Francisco. Because, you know, by 94, here you are on a much bigger label. And, you know, and it's always awkward and really unfair to compare too many different styles of music at once. But, you know, while you all were sort of a, you know, I don't know, a quieter band, you know, and a smaller band on such a big label when things were, when grunge was happening, or even before that in 89, when like Guns N' Roses were happening or something like that, you know, but to be able to be called up.
I know. We would tour America and everyone would be like, why don't you rock? Just rock. And we'd be like, well, rocking is not cool. You know, we don't think rocking is very cool.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so I'm sorry, finish your question.
Well, no, that's perfectly, because by the time you get to San Francisco, you do start hearing the rock songs in there. Like, you know, San Francisco is a very different record than United Kingdom. And we're talking about, you know, a five-year difference.
Yeah, San Francisco was sort of the tail end of everything, you know. Like the guy who produced the first four American Music Club records had long since very bitterly dropped out of the scene. He kicked us out of the studio right after right when we were making the demos for Everclear. So he was way out of the scene. And then Bruce Kappen, who played pedal steel, was really not into the record, and he was really not into being part of it, and he quit. And basically I for that album, because it was so much money, I mean ridiculous amounts of money, and the producer at the time had been working on the same song for 1 month, you know, to the tune of about $50,000 at the time, just to try to make, because Warner Brothers wanted it to be a hit record.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I was complicit. I wrote those songs hoping somehow there would be some kind of hit to pay back Warners for all their dedication. I mean, Warners was actually a great label at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We were really lucky. So it's like, yes, but every time you compromise, it sounds like a compromise. And basically, so we wrote this record. I basically told the band, look, I'm going to mix this with the engineer and I'm going to fire the producer. And that's what I did. Because if you're there sort of at 9 in the morning until 9 or 10 at night every day mixing the same song, and somebody from the band comes in and says, well, this just plain sucks. And you go, okay, what do you mean? Which EQ? Point to the EQ and let's, you know. No, it just sucks. It should sound more like some 4AD band at the time. It's right. Like, well, okay, how do you make that happen? We've just spent like all this fucking money, and here you're just here to sort of like for an hour in your day, and I'm here every day. So anyway, I kicked the band out. They didn't like it, and I don't blame them. And that was actually the sort of the end of the band, that album, because American Youth Club always needed somebody calm and talented, and we had that with Tom Mallon, you know, the guy who fucking hated the fucking music and hated the fucking songs. He was still a very stable person to have in the band. And Bruce, the same thing. Bruce was also very, well, very stable in the band. I mean, we the rest of us were just kind of nuts. I mean, there was so much more alcohol being drunk in this band than you can possibly imagine, you know.
How many six packs?
Oh, fuck me. Yeah. So much alcohol is drunk that without a stable person in the band, it was just going to fall apart. So that, and I mean, there's so many stories around San Francisco. It was such a weird record to make.
You know, I want to take the moment to compliment it, though. And I, you know, San Francisco is one I'd heard here and there, you know, throughout the years. I probably hadn't listened to it in a little while. And I loved it. You know, I put it on the other night, played it straight through, enjoyed every bit of it. You know, I mentioned how many six packs. It's a fun song, even if it is about, you know, a heroin addict, as I recall. Hello, Amsterdam. You know, so here's a song that's very of the time. You know, I can hear that song and I'm like, oh, that sounds very 1994 in the way some of that early Cracker stuff might have sounded or something like that. It's just the kind of that you know, it bops around kind of like that stuff and everything. But I loved it. I didn't. It might feel like 94, but it's still a good song, you know.
Oh, thanks. I don't know. It's a throwaway for me. It's sort of like, you know, honestly, it was just sort of a tribute to the band. We kept playing, you know, playing for incredibly stoned people is always really difficult. They just stare at you and they think, yeah, so now he feels sick. Now he has mental problems, so he should go to the doctor. I'm bored with the music. Go to the doctor. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you like it.
You all had just toured with Pearl Jam a little bit before then, and I did wonder if there was any rub off or influence. And you kind of say that, you know, not about Pearl Jam or anything, but, you know, kind of wanting to write something big like that. But from what I understand, that tour was not fun for you all.
Yeah, it was sort of a disaster. I mean, we had been invited to do the Les Inroctables. I know I'm mispronouncing that. You know, the French magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were amazing. And at the time, they were the most influential paper, I think. And they invited us to do a tour. We should have done it. But instead, we did Pearl Jam. And, you know, just jumping into the maw of commercial America, you know. And Pearl Jam themselves, as human beings, are wonderful. They're really good, generous, warm people, all of them. But, yeah, it was not right for us at all. I mean, the last show we did, we didn't get any shoes thrown at us. Not too many, which was pretty great.
Yeah, they sidebar here. You know, they were sort of famous around that time for doing that. You know, because as band members, they had eclectic tastes beyond what their audience was coming for. You know, and I think they did attract a lot of boneheads around the time because of what was happening. But I've heard that story before from several bands who kind of had that opening slot for Pearl Jam in that time, that it was all sort of the same thing. Like the band really loved them, but the audience hated them.
Yeah. I mean, and we were fools. We should have done Les Inroctables, you know. It's like, I realized another big mistake from American Music Club. Yay.
So when did you know that it was done? Like, you know, San Francisco ends up being the final album for a decade from American Music Club. Like, when, what was the moment where you're like, okay, well, that dream has passed and on to the next chapter?
Well, it was 1999. You know, the band had run out of money, but our management company, who was pretty big at the time, were still commissioning us for every check that was cut. Warner Brothers had given Alias Records about $170,000 as a bonus to buy us from the label. And the first check had gone through, and this was the second check. I think the second check was like for $70,000. And they commissioned us on the check, and we had no money to pay them the commission, you know, because the check came from Warner Brothers, and we were like, we have nothing. And the band was split, basically, like me and Voody were thinking, well, we can go back to touring and sleeping on people's floors. And the other two who were left were thinking, no, we still want a paycheck. We still want our own hotel room. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the band had kind of reached, they still wanted a salary. And we'd had no money for salaries. So I was like, fuck it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and the rest of the band, and I said, well, if this is it, right? I mean, if you are not willing to just be the band we were at the very beginning, then I think we're done. And the band were like, yep, we're done. Bye, Eitzel.
Just like that.
So, like that.
And would you have kept it? I mean, you were in it. You would have kept it going.
I would have kept it going, but I was also like not willing to fund the band.
Right.
That was the thing. And I was, you know, because I had taken my money, my Warner Brothers money. I'd bought a house and a car. The other ones had taken extended vacations. Danny bought a house in Montana, and Voody went to Paris for a while, and I bought a house in San Francisco. So I was like, you know, kind of don't want to support you guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we move on from San Francisco, you know, you kind of said that Hello Amsterdam for you is kind of a toss-off. I mean, are there any songs on there that you remember that still resonate with you?
Cape Caravelle, maybe, or The Revolving Door. People still really like that one. I think at the time we were evolving into we were thinking we were a soul band, you know, Bill Withers, uh-huh. Of course, you know, but I don't know. I don't hate the record at all. I mean, I really don't. I mean, please don't get that impression. I love all these records and I'm proud of making them, you know, really. I'm really proud that I was in this band because we were the best. I think we were one of the best bands ever. I mean, I really do for a minute.
You meant a lot to a lot of people, and I'm definitely one of those, you know, and so listening back on these and kind of reconnecting with those moments, I mean, they are great records. And so as the story goes, and so I'll go ahead and forward, you know, you guys did do two more records, and that made nine. And even that last record, you know, the lineup was different. Is the band put to bed at this point, or is that door still, you know, to put something out under that name? Do you ever want to make it the complete 10?
No. I really don't care. I mean, I'm old now, you know, I'm old. It doesn't matter. It's like no one, you know, like I try every chance I get. I mean, that's the thing about American Music Club. We always shot ourselves in the foot all the time, you know? So I'm not, I mean, next year we're going to really re-release. We finally, after 20 years, we managed to get rights to the first four American Music Club records. So we're going to remaster them all and maybe do some remixing. Probably not, but definitely we digitized all the records and all the outtakes and all the demos and all the shit. We've got gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of stuff that we hate. What we need to go through. We need to pay for the nice man who digitized them. But but after that, we're gonna go through and try to find, you know, the ultimate box set for this for these songs. So this year in all this, there's gonna be a lot of. We're hoping that people will be interested in this. I don't know what the point I'm trying to make. I just don't. You know, I don't want to go into like into the band members or anything like that because that's sort of personal stuff and you know, and they're all really good people and I love them, but for me it's like, why the fuck would I? You know, every single show was a fucking cataclysmic disaster. You know, myself included, there was never a show we played or an album we made where somebody in the band didn't say we fucking suck. That fucking sucked. I don't want to be around that anymore. You know, it's my life's time's too short.
Right.
You know, I don't have that much left. I don't have that much energy to be negative. And this band was always so fucking negative, you know, myself included. I mean, really, but I look at pictures of us then and we just glower. We're miserable motherfuckers. And I don't want to be any part of it.
What you're saying, box sets, all that stuff, you know, the first four albums, like that's very exciting to me because, I mean, if you're someone that just found you all, you know, if like you can't find that stuff very easily, you have to really, really try. So, you know, for that stuff to be available again, that's really, really exciting. And, you know, the idea of a box set, I mean, that's beautiful.
I mean, plus a lot of the outtakes. Like, there's a song called "The Restless Stranger" that I think Warner Brothers released when they did some re-releases, like in the early '90s they re-released "Restless Stranger" and "Engine," and we included all these extra tracks on there. And boy, "Restless Stranger" is an amazing song. It really is. It's like I don't know why we never included it on the album. I think because it was. I think including it on the record would have been the right thing to do, and we never did the right thing.
You know? American Music Club, we never did the right thing. There's your box set title right there. That's it.
I know.
Hit it for a second on the Klamath record too, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary much later this year. I do believe it's at the end of the year. Talking about hard to get to albums, this was one you released on your own through the website, right?
Right.
Yeah. What was the story behind this one? Because this is the first one after that second AMC reunion album.
Yeah. Well, I got some friends who have a cabin up in Klamath in a place called Happy Camp. And I love these people a lot. And they let me stay in their basically in their drying room where they dry the pot. So I stayed in this cabin surrounded by marijuana plants, drying for a good month. And I came up with these songs and recorded most of them in the cabin. So that's where that comes from. It's just sitting surrounded by Bud writing this album.
Which is why it would be so minimalist, I guess.
It's pretty, well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I want, that's the thing. Help Me to Believe from San Francisco, you know, mm-hmm. like, I'm rewriting that. Now the song is called "Help Me to Kill Off My Character," because it was such an ego based sort of song. It was really, you know, like me, you know, and I'm one of these bullshit fucking songs. So you know, why did I go on this tangent? I guess because on Klamath the same thing. I want to redo it. I want to re-sing it because I think the vocals were a little like quiet. And I don't really sing quietly. I just did on that record for some reason. Yeah. I've actually been talking to an engineer in Los Angeles to actually go in there and redo it. And I don't know why I'm redoing everything. And I've also finished a new album of 20 songs that I'm going to do with Bernard Butler this summer.
No, that's the best news. I mean, a new album. You know, of course I was hoping for that. You know, of course I was going to ask for that.
Oh,
yeah. But I will. Two more things for Klamath anyway. While I'm here,
All right.
Compliment. One's not really a question. Why I'm Bullshit. That song right there. I've watched probably 4 or 5 live performances. That's on YouTube of that one, and that is such a fun song. Every time I've seen those live performances to watch you do, it is so theatrical how you get into that one. So that's wonderful. So any chance that, you know, brings that one, I guess, back in the limelight, I think I'll enjoy that.
I like doing that song, you know. It's probably the truest song ever written about me. Why I'm Bullshit.
I'm Bullshit.
It's all about the mission. Yeah. Yeah.
It was Franz Nicolai part of that record?
Franz Nicolai was part of the tour.
Okay.
I toured with him extensively in Europe.
That's why I was trying to figure out the credits that I saw his name tossed around, but I didn't know if he was on the album or just helping you out.
He was just helping. I don't think he was on the album. I could be wrong. No, because I did all this myself. So yeah. I live in this place. For instance, I started writing with my friend Simon Stevens. So I started writing for theater at the same time. And I Live in This Place was written for a play that we co-wrote called Marine Parade. It's a little trivia.
Oh, he's good for that stuff too. And there's a line on it. I think it's on the last song. We're all going to be forgotten. Let's face it. It's all we have in store. I thought.
Is that right? I don't know the lyrics anymore.
Yeah, there's a line. There's a line right towards the end of that record. And I thought, what a beautiful sentiment, whether I believe it or not. And I say I don't believe it.
Is that Ronald Cole was a rock star?
Yeah, it's that one. Sorry.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and
Ronald Cole.
Oh, go on. Sorry.
No. Ron Cole was a rock star in Columbus, Ohio, in the '80s. He was the biggest. He just he's the first person I ever met that just was charismatic. You know, like there's a lot, you meet people in your life and you know that they're rock stars, you know, and Ron Cole was, you know, wanted to be David Bowie a little bit too much. I think that's in the song. But anyway, sorry.
We're all going to be forgotten. Let's face it. It's all we have in store. And I thought, that's kind of funny and a little bit ironic as here I am just remembering all of these great moments throughout your catalog. You know, that's so nothing to worry about there. You know, we'll keep that flame burning for you. what else can you tell me about that new record, if anything? I mean, 20 songs, you know, you're working on it this summer. I mean, is there anything that's, you know, newsworthy about this at this point?
There's no story. That's what my manager in England keeps telling me is, like, you got to have a story. And I just like, well, I don't really have a story. I'm just writing these horrible songs, you know? So I don't know. They're real. I don't know. It's either the worst thing or the best thing I've ever written. I bet it's the worst, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's anything like your last one with Hey, Mr. Ferryman, which was one of my favorite records of that year, I still worship that record. We wear it out around the house. My wife loves it and puts it on all the time. And if it's any kind of continuation of that, you know, we're going to be right there for it.
I don't think it is going to be a continuation of that. It's pretty fucking bleak, you know. It's pretty dark, so
well,
I don't know.
So are the times we live in. And
I know. God bless.
A reflection of, maybe. I can't wait to hear it. I look forward to hearing it. It sounds like it's still a little bit of ways before I'll get to, but I'm excited that it's going to happen.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for taking the trip here, a 30-year trip, as it were. I always appreciate your time, and I'll look forward to catching up again when we got a record to talk about.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
And a big old thanks to Mark Eitzel talking about American Music Clubs at United Kingdom in San Francisco, his solo record, Klamath. I cannot wait to hear what he's got in store on this next solo record as well, dark as it might be. Hey, if you haven't already, please hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now, whether it's at Apple Podcasts and iTunes, Spotify. If you're listening on YouTube, you can do it there as well. Then head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern. You can also find some bonus episodes of this series over there. Head to Consequence of Sound to get your music and film news. You can find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith, Facebook/Kyle Meredith. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.